Welcome to Drinks Insider, the podcast that's interested in everything you can drink. If it's legal, if you can sell it, and more importantly, if you can make money from it, then we're going to talk about it. So come on this journey into the commercial world of everything drinkable. I'm your host, Felicity Carter, and you're listening to Drinks Insider. How do you go from being someone renowned for their ability to brand and market top alcohol drinks to starting a foresight agency centered around non-alcoholic alternatives? Well, you have an epiphany in California. Daniel Rowntree worked at Bacardi before launching a drinks specialist marketing agency that was sold in 2015. Since then, he's also co-founded Brew Broker, a digital marketplace to connect the beer trade, plus a beer brand, Big Hug Brewing, among other ventures. But in April 2024, he founded High and Dry, a London-based foresights agency to help usher in a new age of non-alcoholic and functional drinks. He's also opened up a business coaching agency to help drinks entrepreneurs. And in this episode, we talk about what made him change direction and where he sees the future of drinks. As always, the takeaways will be in the newsletter, which you'll find at drinksinsider.com. And if you've got a suggestion for the podcast, drop me a line at felicity@drinksinsider.com. Daniel, great to see you.
Great to see you too.
Okay, let's get straight into it. You have founded a company called High and Dry, but you've also got a very long history in the beverage alcohol industry. So why did you start High and Dry? When did you start it and what is it?
Great question. So High and Dry is a foresights agency and collaboration studio. But before I explain exactly what that means, let me take you back in time, two decades, to the beginning of my career. I've had 20 years in the alcohol industry. I started 23, 24, working for Bacardi, did a couple of sales and marketing roles, absolutely loved the industry. It was a great place to work. My first job was looking after all of the nightclubs and members clubs and
in your 20s, did that mean a lot of late nights?
It was amazing. I was obviously very popular with my friends, able to get on most of the lists and free drinks, etc. Bacardi was a great place to work. I believe it still is. But I went on a bit of a journey there and got promoted relatively quickly, and I went on a Being Bacardi course. And it was at that moment I realised that actually the corporate world wasn't for me. I was driving away from Southampton in my Audi A4, feeling like a young Alan Partridge, and realised I had to do something about it. So I left.
Can I just stop you? Yeah. What was the Being Bacardi course? That sounds interesting.
Well, I think as you get a certain level within businesses, and I totally understand why you do this, you know, you then kind of like educate people about what it is to be, I guess, a leader at Bacardi. And, you know, I know other businesses do this. When you get to a certain level, then they go, okay, well, this is how we do things. And it was almost like cultural norms, behavioral codes, things like that. And I think at that point, I just realized that I wasn't equipped for a long journey in the corporate world.
Was there a particular thing that you thought, that doesn't resonate with me?
Not one thing, lots of things. I think it was the thought that I was signing up to something that was a bit more kind of permanent than I wanted.
Right.
I've always had this notion that I will run my own business at some point. And it was at that point I was like, look, this is it. I'm no longer up for, towing a corporate line, as it were. So I wanted to create my own culture. Own thing. So I awarded my yet to be formed agency a job as the last thing I did as trade marketing manager of Grey Goose. So my agency was called Elastic, and I went on my own founder-led journey then, from myself and a co-founder up to 45 people and about £5 million turnover. And
okay, hang on, you have to tell me how you did that. That is quite interesting. I mean, you must have been quite young at the time you did that.
Yeah, 24, 25. And, I think I look back at my young self going into kind of, you know, I guess boardrooms to speak to marketing directors and marketing managers about trying to convince them to give their marketing budget to me.
And how did you do it? What were you offering that they needed?
Well, I had context in the alcohol industry, and I realized quite early on that going narrow and deep and being the only person that was or the one of a few people that really knew their subject matter was important. So as Elastic, we kind of like evolved our offering over time. At the beginning of that journey, we were everything to everybody, but quite quickly we realized that that's not a good way to stand out. So like, you know, many of the businesses that I've been part of since, going narrow and deep and understanding your subject matter and who your consumer is really important. And when I talk about consumer, I mean marketing directors in the alcohol industry. So, you know, we focused heavily on on-trade activation and experiential, so really analog marketing, really, so not much digital, but even though we did do stuff around digital, but it was more to amplify the experience. But we worked with all the big booze brands over the 13 years that I grew that business. So AB InBev was a 7-8 year client, Diageo 7-8 year client, Pernod Ricard 6 or 7 years, Bacardi obviously, Heineken.
We are going to get back to High and Dry. We absolutely are. But I just want to ask you a couple of questions about this, because this is fantastically insightful. In the years since, do you think the way that on-trade activation and sampling and so on has changed, or are the principles still always the same principles?
It's a really good question. I mean, they have evolved because technology is evolved. But, you know, I think the principles are still there. You know, ultimately, on-trade activation is there to drive rate of sale and trial. I always used to say to my clients, I was like, look, you work really hard on getting your distribution, and we will kind of dovetail and, you know, team up with you to get your rate of sale up. So, you know, I do believe that trade marketing and on-trade activation plays a huge part even now. And I think, you know, technology only amplifies that. So, you know, driving consumers to bar using, you know, near-field technology, you know, engaging people online post their experience is really important. But, you know, it's still really the same principles. You've got to engage all of the decision makers. So, you know, the person that's, you know, signing off the budget, whether that be, you know, the owner of the bar or the bar chain, and then you've got to engage the bar manager, and then you've got to engage the people that are actually serving your drink, the real ambassadors, the bartenders, and finally, you've got to engage the consumers in bar. But, you know, each of those touch points needs to be covered off in order for you to have a really engaged on-trade activation campaign.
Okay, so you're very young. You've got this incredibly successful agency with really big clients and large staff. And then what happened?
Well, you know, it didn't always feel like that, Felicity. You know, it's 13 years to grow that business. And, you know, there's some pretty dark times within that that period, because, you know, we were bootstrapped. It was an era where, you know, investment wasn't really a thing. You know, Crowdcube or the options for kind of funding didn't really exist. So we just, you know, if we wanted to grow the business, we had to get more business, you know, and we were funding our growth through profits. So, you know, it was a slow road to get to an exit. And if I'm totally honest, when we had, the first conversation about potentially exiting to Matthew Clark, I had no idea it was on the cards. You know, we went to go and talk to Gary Squire, who was an old boss of mine at Bacardi. And I just thought, oh, there might be a brief in this for me. And he was like, actually, Dan, we're looking to buy an agency. Mm. I was like, okay, I didn't see that coming. And strategically for Matthew Clark, they were trying to kind of diversify their profit. You know, wholesaling is, you know, a single digit margin business. So what I didn't realize at the time is that Matthew Clark were also looking to sell their business or their group of businesses. So I think they were diversifying their skill set.
Can you explain who Matthew Clark is for listeners in the US?
Sorry, yeah, Matthew Clark is one of the biggest wholesalers in the UK, and it was the biggest by a long way at the time, but I don't know if that's still the case. I believe it is so. So similar to a Southern Glazers or
R&DC, yeah. R&DC. All right, so obviously it was sold, and then mm-hmm. and then what did you do next?
So I stayed on in a couple of years as MD, and you know, as I mentioned, the parent business, Matthew Clark, went through a few changes during that time. They sold to another business that was AIM listed, which is a small business stock market in the UK. And unfortunately, there was some governance that happened at the time that meant that there was a big hole in the finances, and that business imploded. And we as a kind of a subsidiary within it were brought along with that unfortunate situation. And we were bought, as Matthew Clark were, out of administration, I think, by CNC, which are the owners of Magners. And I distinctly remember a conversation with Stephen Glancy, who was the then MD, who flew down to Bristol to have 20 minutes with me and my co-founder. And he was like, I have no idea why Matthew Clark bought an agency. And just so you know, you won't be our strategic priority from here on in. I was like, oh, okay. So it's my life's work here. So that was pretty soul destroying, but I understood it. It's business, you know.
Yeah, I mean, we all understand business decisions, but it's still pretty shattering. So how did you, obviously at some point you picked yourself up. How did you move on from there?
Well, me and my co-founder, I guess, formulated another management team and then thought we would buy the business back. So we offered what we thought a very fair price, more than what they sold it to us for, to buy it back. And we went to the bank to raise some debt, and that was absolutely fine, no problem. We had a good trajectory in which to pay that back. But they decided not to accept the offer, which, again, I understood. They said, look, it's not a signal that we want to be sending to the city, selling off assets. So I was like, well,
so we've got something we don't want to use, but we don't want to signal to competitors that we made a mistake.
Yeah, or that, you know, it's the sign of something else. You know, they're going to start selling off assets, I assume.
Do you know, that is such a business mistake. I once read a book by Felix Dennis on how to make money. You know, he was a billionaire, and he said more wealth is lost through people being fearful, you know, than is created, because a lot of people are just like, what are they going to think of us? And they don't make decisions, or they make bad decisions like that.
Like, so coming from a context of scarcity rather than an abundance. Yeah, no, I'm a big believer in that, in business and in life. Definitely something I've learned over the last year or two, for sure, that the context in which you come from really does dictate the results of your actions.
It certainly does. All right, so I keep interrupting you. So.
Yeah, no worries. That's what we're here for, right? Asking the questions. So, you know, we formulated this plan to buy the business back. They said no. So I decided it was time to leave. And then within 6 months of us leaving, me and my co-founder, they closed the business, unfortunately. So it was a shame, a life's work gone. But in many ways, that's what happens when, you know, you found a business, you exit, the control goes elsewhere, and you get paid for that. So that's part of the deal. And I think like many founders, I found I was quite lost after that. There was one part of me that thought I was invincible and I can do anything I'd set my mind to. And the other part was like, oh my gosh, my identity's now gone. I used to be the founder MD of, you know, Elastic at the time. And that was me for 13 years previous. So now what? So during the time at Elastic, we'd also set up or I'd helped set up other businesses, one of those being Brew Broker, which was a tech platform in the brewing industry. I'd helped a friend set up a socially conscious beer brand called Big Hug. We also, during the time of Elastic, created a beer festival called Craft Beer Rising, which was sold with the deal with Elastic to Matthew Clark, but we reincarnated that business as Brew London, and that still exists today as well.
Okay, yeah. So you've worked with an accelerator, and you've worked with a variety of funding sources. You've worked with family and friends, private equity, venture funds. Can you tell the audience what's the difference between these sources how you unlock the money and what kinds of businesses they're suited for?
Great question. So, look, and I guess when I rolled out of Elastic and I was a bootstrap business and that's all I knew and rolled into the world of, you know, fundraising, you know, this was a tricky conundrum to unravel. And I think the way I tend to look at it is there's a kind of investor investment fit. So not every investor wants to see every investment. Mm-hmm. So, you know, it's really important that the founder or the business that's raising money understands what type of capital that they need. And, you know, you mentioned a couple there, for example. If you're an early stage business prior to revenue in any way, then you're looking at high net worth individuals. You're looking at, you know, investment syndicates, potentially crowd funders. You know, I think I've forgotten what the US version of that is. I think it is crowdfunder when the UK version is seeders. So I had experience of running a couple of those campaigns. And then the other source of capital you mentioned, for example, private equity, there's specific metrics that those businesses need to see in terms of growth, you know, product market fit, your ability to scale in multiple markets, for example. And then you've got, you know, family offices, which is a bit of an untapped resource, I feel. But there's so many of them, and it's a world that I knew nothing about until I was exposed to it, and it's phenomenal.
And let's go back a step, because now we're talking about something that you currently do, which is you're coaching people. Mm-hmm. So let's go back to, how did you end up founding High and Dry, and what is it? Talk me through that.
Yeah, sure. So basically, essentially, I did the accelerator, went over to America. I stopped drinking and realized there was a big explosion of non-alc globally, and specifically in the US.
So when did you go to the US?
2022, October 2022.
So what were you doing during the pandemic?
So I was working on building this accelerator, but from the UK.
All right. So and when did you start the accelerator?
2019. So just April 2019. So we were accelerating the drinks of the future. We had a remit to invest in the drinks that were going to be relevant 5 to 10 years from 2019.
Oh, wow. So in 2019, you were trying to predict. Do you think in the end of 2024 that your predictions were correct?
It remains to be seen. I'll be honest. We made some decent bets. I think, you know, without naming any names, because I can't, you know, I think we did okay.
Can you talk about what kinds of drinks you were talking about that you saw in the future? Did you, for example, pick up on the extraordinary growth of RTDs?
We had some discussions with RTD businesses, we couldn't find the right one to fit our kind of thesis. But yes, that was one of the opportunity spaces we were looking at. The other one being non-alc, obviously, and some of them were nascent categories that we thought were going to have a renaissance again, which I think was a bet that we will probably see come to fruition.
Okay, right. Let's talk about all of this. So then at some point you went to the US, is that right?
Correct, yeah. So between 2020 and 2022, I was back and forth to America, integrating some of these businesses into the portfolio and understanding a little bit more about them and also the market. And it's October 2022, I moved my family out there we lived in Los Angeles for just over a year. And
why was that? Was that because there was just so much opportunity in the beverage space, or you liked the lifestyle, or you got sick of the UK?
I definitely wasn't sick of the UK. We moved to America because that's the most, well, it's the biggest market with the biggest opportunity. Again, part of the theory was that, you know, if we made it work in America, the exit value would be more.
And of course, the American market is very lucrative, but it's also very tough compared to anywhere else in the world because of the three-tier system and so on. So did you have a drinks culture shock when you were there?
Well, yes. I mean, look, something happened, Felicity. I wasn't at that business as long as I wanted to be. I definitely kind of like from a cultural perspective, clashed a little bit with my with my founding team and, you know, the business that I was part of. And as a result, we parted ways. And I think part of that was that I also had fallen out of love with the booze industry a little bit. You know, I had stopped drinking at the time, and it was difficult for me to get as passionate about that space as I was previously. So that definitely played a part. It wasn't a reason, but it definitely played a part. So, you know, I was immersed while I was in America with not only the amazing, you know, drinks and cocktail culture that exists there, but also the alternatives to alcohol that are a lot more accessible there than they are in the UK. So THC specifically, but also there were markets opening up for psychedelics and also ketamine therapy, MDMA, for example, were being reappraised on a more kind of national level. But also this kind of like health and wellness angle, specifically in LA, where they had embraced nootropics and adaptogens, and it was sort of commonplace. So CBD in the UK is a little bit more kind of a rarity, a delicacy. It's becoming a little bit more popular, but in America, it was just commonplace. So I was now exposed to this world where it was socially acceptable not to drink, and there were other mood altering alternatives. So that ultimately was the jumping off point for High and Dry. So I was a passionate, I guess, non-alc consumer, but not an anti-alc campaigner, because that would be naive. And I was just becoming aware of this lifestyle. In California, they call it Cali Sober. Mm. It's where you abstain from, you know, kind of alcohol and other addictive substances and lean into, you know, I guess, cannabis, psychedelics, nootropics, adaptogens as part of a kind of a wellness choice, rather than it being, I guess a drug, which is, you know, has previously been the kind of label that's been put upon these substances.
Yeah, I'm a little bit, having spent some time in New York and being knocked over by the smell of marijuana, I'm slightly cynical about the wellness claims. I think it's, but anyway, continue.
No, you're right as well. Like everything, you know, in life, there needs moderation, there needs context, it needs set and setting, you know, just the same as alcohol, you know, what works for you does not work for me. And it's very difficult to kind of have a one size fits all policy.
So, okay. So you're immersed in this, the wellness culture, and it is wellness culture and, you know, an explosion of creativity in non-alc and so on. What brought you back to the UK?
Well, my time, was up with the venture business. And with that went my visa. And to be perfectly honest with you, it was, an educational decision for my daughter who, was just coming into her GCSEs, and I thought I owed it to her to have a, you know, an English education. You know, so we came back to the UK and, basically set up home, not shop, down in Cornwall. So
it's oh, Cornwall, cool, lovely.
Yes, it is. It's beautiful, beautiful place to live. And, you know, with the new skills that I had, as a coach, I'd previously, 2 years actually previously, qualified as a coach, as a business coach. And, you know, I thought to myself, well, what is a way that I can use my 2 decades worth of, experience building businesses and help a new generation of, I guess, founders in this space. And yeah, no, I'm happy to say that I have a relatively full practice at the moment and have lots of amazing businesses that I'm working with. So it's a very rewarding vocation. And I say vocation, and I don't say it lightly, because I didn't realize until a year ago that it probably was the thing I'm destined to do. When I came back to the UK, I was hell bent on working out what business I was going to create. So I did what I know best, as I created a business called High and Dry, but also, you know, a coaching practice, which is keeping me very busy at the moment.
So are they separate entities or are they the same entity?
They're separate entities.
All right, so start with High and Dry.
Mm-hmm. So yeah, so High and Dry is a Foresights agency and collaboration studio. So I realized that this is a long game for me. So, you know, we in the UK are a little bit behind in terms of legislation. So what I'm trying to do is work with what's legal in the UK at the moment. And
you're talking about things like psychedelics and...
No, so I'm specifically talking about the non-alt movement, and the second wave of moderation. So I kind of describe the first wave of moderation is all of the replacements to classic alcohol. So, you know, the seed lips, the clean co, etc., that are replicating a vodka or a gin. That's the first wave of moderation. The second wave of moderation, in terms of my vernacular, is, you know, replicating mouthfeel, replicating the luxury experience of alcohol, replicating the mood in some ways, adding adaptogens, nootropics, creating new flavors and experiences that are standalone rather than trying to replicate alcohol. Yeah. So I'm here for this kind of second wave of moderation to help bigger businesses understand this space and make moves in this space, to mitigate against the opportunities and threats of what could potentially come down the line. I do think it's inevitable that we will have, a legal cannabis market in the UK at some point.
Okay, so what is a Foresights agency? Talk me through that.
Okay, so Foresights agency is, I'm selling dreams of the future. So I help work with your current scenario, and then I help kind of, basically, like see into the future with the signals that we're seeing out there in the world.
How do you do that?
So we look for different signals in culture at the moment. So, and things that are happening specifically around kind of consumer behavior and how people are acting. And we go deep into different cities, and we have influencers on the ground that can help us understand what is going to be coming in the future. And, you know, the business that I'm currently, you know, working on is about kind of like taking current situations of, you know, kind of bigger businesses and applying lots of kind of like Foresights expertise about what could and couldn't happen in the future. And
right. Let's get into this. I would be very interested in your Foresights on alcohol.
Okay. So, I believe there is a world in the not too distant future where alcohol is not the only mood altering substance available. So if alcohol is not the only mood altering substance available, and the majority of the high street establishments that we know and love all have bars in them geared up to sell alcohol, how will that evolve the places that we socialize at the moment? So, you know, my view is that, you know, bars will not just sell alcohol, they will sell moods. You'll go into a bar and say, well, I would like to have some calm, please. I would like to have some excitement, please. So, you know, there will be different, substances available in bars alongside alcohol. So what are the implications of that? You know, my thoughts are that, businesses like Diageo, Heineken will no longer just be selling alcohol. They will be selling experiences, moods. They'll be diversifying into soft drinks, you know, into other mood altering substances. You know, that's the future, I believe. You know,
this is something I've been giving a lot of thought to. A couple of weeks ago, I read a book called Drunk by a Canadian academic, and he looks at the role that alcohol has played in civilization. And one of the things he says is the evidence suggests that at a particular blood alcohol level, we lose enough inhibitions that we can actually start to talk to strangers and meet potential romantic partners, and that alcohol has played this really incredibly important role, even though it's also a very hazardous substance that leads to all sorts of problems. And I'm just wondering, you know, I've seen bars that sell non-alcs purely have gone out of business. And I wonder how much having a drug that makes you rowdy is actually really important for those gathering places. Like some of these other drugs, particularly marijuana, are great for you personally, but they're not great for socializing. So how would you have a establishment that has lots of different mood altering when some of those things make you social and some of them don't?
Yeah, I think it's a really good provocation. I think, you know, alcohol has played an important part in society, for a long, long time. And I don't think there will be a world where it totally disappears. I just think that there will be other options available. So I think it's also depends on what mood you're in, because, you know, in alcohol, in many ways, you know, if you're coming into it not feeling like you want to be in a kind of up mood, then it's probably going to make you fall asleep. So it's the same with THC, for example. It's all about kind of what mood you approach these substances with, what context you're coming from, rather than, you know, the ultimate kind of, end result, because it will be different for everybody. And I do believe that, you know, THC, for example, certain strains of THC will make you more social. Same with, you know, smaller doses of, you know, psilocybin. So I don't think it's like, because those things may become available, the rowdiness that you term is going to stop. I do think there are substances that will still aid a social occasion and help, you know, grease the gears of conversation.
Yeah, it's interesting. So at the moment, as I understand it, the non-alcoholic drinks are actually being bought by people who drink alcohol, you know, the zebra striping phenomenon. So you've talked about the analog. Obviously, the analogs sit in that space, the fake gin and tonic and so on. What's the next generation, and who's going to be consuming it?
Well, I spoke about it briefly. It's, you know, I think it is about trying to create new experiences and new flavor journeys for newer consumers, because if you haven't got the social pressure to learn or to if you haven't got the social pressure to teach yourself how to like alcohol, as we did as we were growing up, potentially these other substances are going to be more appealing to you. So if you'd never taught yourself how to like alcohol, why would you want an alcohol replacement? So yeah. I do believe that the next wave of kind of non-alc is about creating amazing kind of flavor experiences that have the same kind of experience in many ways to alcohol in terms of balance, mouthfeel, mood altering, but don't replicate the taste. So it will be like any kind of like tribe, there will be a sense of ownership for a younger consumer. And, you know, typically you don't want to consume the products that your parents are consuming. Mm-hmm. So you will be looking for things that define you as an individual and you as a kind of generation.
Yeah, I've been having lots of conversations lately with people in wine. So my background is mostly as a wine writer rather than in lots of other beverages. And we're talking about what happens if alcohol ceases to be a social norm. And probably in wine, what we would see is we would see it revert to its historical norm, which it becomes the drink of rich people. It becomes something that's no longer accessible to everybody. That's a speculation. But where do you see things like beer and spirits going if alcohol ceased to be a normal thing to do?
Oh, look, I don't see it. I don't see it disappearing in by any means. I just believe that the choice of non-alcs is just going to get more varied, and I do believe that there is going to be some blurrings of lines of industries. You know, so, you know, for example, Coca-Cola bought Finlandia Brewery. There is an alcoholic Mountain Dew. You've got beer brands that are acting like supplements businesses. Impossible Brew, for example, has kind of adaptogenic ingredients, and they almost act like a subscription service, like Heights do, who are a kind of supplements business in the UK. So I'd see a blurring of industry lines, and I do see you know, kind of maybe beer acting like wine, wine acting like beer. You know, there is going to be different crossovers and interesting kind of ideas will be pollinated between kind of industries.
Yeah, and actually the real headache in all of this is actually for legislators. I keep an eye on what people are talking about, and at the moment there's a lot of speculation about how non-alcs will be regulated, because there's the question of if younger people drink zero alcohol things, are you actually introducing them to alcohol brands, and therefore should you stop them drinking it and so on. So once you start to introduce, you know, adaptogens and things like that, it's a whole new ball of things for parliamentarians to talk about. Okay, so let's talk about your founding business. What mm-hmm. sort of your coaching business. If I came to you and I said, I want to do an RTD, I've got this great idea, it's going to be a brown spirit and whatever, what's the process of coaching?
Okay, cool. Well, I mean,
and by the way, I've got no money. That's my other problem. I've got this great idea. It's a great product, but I can afford to pay for your coaching, but marketing and distribution is, it's all a bit of pain.
Okay, well, to start with, we would have a discovery call to see if we fit as individuals, as people, and I'd ask you lots of questions about your life, about who you are, about why you're doing it, etc. And then we would, and if that was still, if we still got on after that, we would have another coaching call for an hour where we would talk in detail about you and your business. And we would start to work through, you know, why, you know, understand kind of your mission, your values, your purpose, and then what you want to achieve and in what time frame. You know, I think it's really important to understand, you know, what the end goal is before you encounter your startup founder journey. And, you know, then we would design a plan bespoke to you in order to get to where you want to get to. My kind of thinking is that you need to clarify your North Star. You need to create a plan in order to get there, and then you need to surrender.
Okay, let's give a specific example of what I imagine people want to know. Let's say I've started a brand. It's doing really well in my local area. I've got some local distribution. It's doing fantastically well. Maybe even I'm looking at national distribution, and now I want to go into the export market, but I need money. How easy is it to get money in the alcohol space, which of course is a vice that many people won't invest in? What do I need to consider before I go looking for money?
So, you know, I guess it's not a formulaic model, but it's one that I like and have used in the past, and it's learn, validate and scale. So if you're able to learn and test the market out, and you've got traction in that geographic market or in that channel, and you've proven that the money that you're employing to get rate of sale is working for you, and you've then validated that in a couple of other markets, then that's the time that you should be able to go and unlock investors' money, because at that point, the money that they're going to be putting on your business is going to be fueling growth and not fueling, you know, kind of like setup costs or infrastructure, etc. So if you really have got your business to a position where the incremental money that you raise is going to fuel growth, then you're in a very attractive position.
What are the typical mistakes that you see people making?
So proposition is a key challenge, right? So, you know, it's a very crowded market. So it's not okay to be bigger, better. You have to stand out. So you have to be different. So understanding who your tribe is and speaking to that individual or that group of people directly is really important. You can make a lot of money alienating 90% of the market, but focusing intently on 10%.
It's interesting. One of the things I've been told by many entrepreneurs is that you need something that is new, but not so new that people don't know what to do with it. What do you think?
Yeah, no, absolutely. I think there's a great book called No Bullshit Strategy by Alex Smith, and he talks about weirding weirding the normal, you know, so it needs to be, it needs to feel familiar but different. So, you know, you need to go, you know, one step away from normal in order for it to get traction. So that's just one of the two strategies it has in the book. And the other one is normalizing the weird. So if you're weirding the normal, you don't want to go too far.
How do you normalize the weird?
So normalizing the weird, for example, would be, if we're going to go in the context of high and dry, would be normalizing a THC seltzer, for example. At the moment, that's pretty weird for people because you're like, okay, that has marijuana in it. And marijuana, in my mind, means that you're a bit of a loser and a bit of a waster, because that's the story I've been telling myself. But ultimately, if you were able to position that brand as THC also helps with recovery in the environment of kind of athletics and sport, then you are kind of normalizing that previously very weird.
That's so interesting. I thought you were going to say, so if you can make it look posh or if you can make it tap into nostalgia, but you're actually tapping into something else entirely. That's really interesting.
Yes. And then look, that this is, you know, again, like it's not, these aren't my theories. They're Alex Smith's. And I definitely would implore you to read his book. It's very thin, but it's an amazing
thin books. Okay. You've also invested in plant-based medicines. Why and how?
So that business is called Phytome, and it's actually on the Roseland Peninsula, which is down in Cornwall. And when I came back from America, I was looking for some context and some relevance in this alternative to alcohol space. And Phytome had one of the only legal home office licenses to grow cannabis, but they were growing cannabis for the use in pharmaceutical drugs. And this absolutely fascinated me. So I contacted the CEO and said, look, I'm living in Newquay and you're only around the corner. I'd love to come and see your campus and the way you do things. That happened. I had a great conversation with him and I ended up making an investment and also helping them from a CMO perspective, you know, with some strategy and some social media. But I've since realized that, you know, the cannabis element is just one tiny little bit of the amazing work they're doing there. And they're working with plants in, you know, all plants in order to unlock the potential that those plants have to, I guess, revolutionize medicine. So using plants as the basis to unlock the healing, I guess, properties of plants and apply those to drugs in a classic drug development pathway.
Okay. So, all right. So to sum up, you've had an incredible journey. You've gone from some of the biggest alcohol companies in the world to now working on plant-based medicines and the non-alc space. When you look across the drinks landscape, what do you think is particularly promising for the future?
Promising for the future. I mean, look, we always come into contact with the liquids as consumers, but for me, it's all about the people behind those liquids. So what's promising about the future is that, you know, we've got an amazing entrepreneurial backbone in this country and globally, and I think there is some phenomenal founders out there that are going to always push the boundaries. So I'm always bullish when I meet amazing founders and individuals doing amazing things. So as long as there are people out there willing to challenge the status quo and to create things that consumers don't even know they want yet, then we're all going to be okay.
The corollary of that is I was always fascinated. When I was a teenager, I had a girlfriend and her parents had a home bar and they had Crème de Menthe, which is the world's most disgusting liqueur from my point of view, and it's completely disappeared. And I'm really interested. I've got really interested in these drinks that used to be iconic and then they vanished. I'm sure there's some listener going, I make a Crème de Menthe and it's fantastic. But do you have any thoughts about why some things just vanish, never to be seen again?
Well, I mean, I guess it is because they fall out of of relevance, and maybe taste change. And I guess, you know, that it's that kind of notion that I alluded to previously, that no one wants to drink, you know, drinks that their parents drank. So, you know, they become less relevant. And unless, you know, you've got clever marketeers behind them, you know, repositioning them and making them relevant to a new generation, they fall by the wayside.
Like absinthe, I guess. You know, once they're gone, they're gone. They don't really ever come back. All right, final thoughts on the drink space.
Ah, I absolutely love it. And, you know, I think the next sort of 5 to 10 years will be interesting, you know, to understand, you know, how quickly the non-alc sector is going to take hold. Because let's be honest, it still is only 1 or 2% of total global alcohol sales. So I think the next 5 or 10 years will be interesting to see if some of my provocations will come true about alcohol declining and non-alc and other mood altering alternatives will take place.
Great. Daniel, thank you very much for your time.
Thank you very much. Really appreciated the questions.
You've been listening to Drinks Insider, the podcast that explores the intersection of beverages and commerce. Now, if you would like a summary of this episode, sign up for the Drinks Insider newsletter, which sends you the takeaways. Just go to drinksinsider.com and add your name. And if there's something you think we should be talking about, drop me a line at felicity@drinksinsider.com. And before you go, please don't forget to rate this podcast. 5 stars are most welcome.